From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a big gamble, even for a man who likes to roll the dice. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon shook the world of Israeli politics and more when he announced he is leaving the conservative Likud party, the party he founded and long personified, to pursue a new vision of Israel's national goals. Sharon is 77. He's been bitterly at odds with party hardliners over his decision to pull Israeli settlers out of Gaza and part of the West Bank. He now says he will run for a third term as prime minister as candidate of the new National Responsibility Party. Elections are likely to be held in March. The ramifications stretch from Israel and the West Bank across the Middle East to Iraq and Washington. This hour On Point, Ariel Sharon remaking the politics of Israel and maybe of the Middle East. You can join the conversation. How do you read the Sharon earthquake? What's going on here, and what will it mean for Israel, for the U.S., for the region? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later this hour, we'll talk about the big layoffs at General Motors. But first, Sharon. Joining me from Jerusalem is Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Steve Erlanger, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Steve, what brought Israel and Ariel Sharon to this pass?
Well, what brought Ariel Sharon to this pass was an understanding, finally, that the Likud party, which he helped create in 1973, had run out of steam. Likud was based really on an ideology of Jewish sovereignty over the entire biblical land of Israel, which includes the West Bank and Gaza. And his unilateral disengagement from Gaza, his pulling all Israeli settlers and troops out of Gaza and four settlements in the West Bank, was in a real way a betrayal of his party and its principles. He forced it through, but he felt if he was going to win again, he didn't want to face a third term with that kind of internal resistance to anything that he wanted to do that could be termed progress with the Palestinians. So as far as one can tell, that brought him there. He's 77. He has his legacy in mind. His intimates say he wants to be the person who draws the final borders of the state of Israel, which have been, you know, in play ever since the 1967 war. And I think, in a way, he was also sick of the faces around him. I think he felt he'd outgrown them and that he'd understood that the Likud ideology wasn't really useful anymore and was blocking, at least in his view, the country from necessary goals.
Steve Erlanger, give us the nuts and bolts, if you would, of polls and policy here. First, polls. Ariel Sharon will stand again with a new party, the National Responsibility Party, we're told. What can he hope to achieve at the polls? Is he guaranteed to come back as prime minister? What's required for him to remain in power on the other side of this?
Well, there are no guarantees, and this is why it was a gamble. Had he chosen to stay in Likud, he probably would have come back much more easily as prime minister, but then would have faced internal dissent. The polls this early on probably don't mean very much, but what they tell us is that a Sharon party, which actually, you know, has no other face much except his own, and even the name isn't quite clear. Some people now suggest it might be incorporated as Kadima, which means forward. His, you know, the early polls say he would get about 30 seats in the 120-seat parliament. Labour, under its new leader, a younger man born in Morocco, a trade union leader named Amir Peretz, would get 26 or so seats, so quite close to Sharon. And the rump of Likud would get 15, 16 seats. But what it would mean is that, you know, no Israeli party has ever won an overall majority in parliament. But it'd have to be a coalition. The assumption is that if Sharon wins the most seats, he then would become prime minister and would put together a coalition with Labour and other smaller parties. But here, we're really speculating. It's very hard to know. But what he needs to be to become prime minister is to be head of the party that wins the most seats in parliament. The polls now say that he will do that, but the election more than 3 months away.
So as you say, anything could happen, but let's look forward. If he succeeds at that, let's turn from polls to policy. What is the policy that Ariel Sharon felt he could not implement effectively at the head of Likud that he hopes to implement at the head of a new party, a new coalition?
Well, that's exactly the right question, and I really don't know the answer because Mr. Sharon, at his press conference last night, which was televised, refused to give an answer. Basically, his answer was it's the same policy as before, trust me. What he said was that he wanted to provide leadership of the nation that would lay the foundation for a peace agreement that would control the final borders of the state of Israel. The implication of all that is that he would pull out of more of the West Bank. But he also said, quite specifically, as he said many times before, that Gaza was the last of the unilateral withdrawals. Now, it may be he'd be willing to withdraw a coordinated way with the Palestinians or in a negotiated way. But what he insisted last night is that his policy will be the roadmap. And the roadmap, as your listeners probably know, is a kind of notional plan for a peace process that was started in 2003, is supposed to end at the end of this year, and in fact has been rather dormant. I mean, we haven't even gotten to the first stage of the roadmap. But the roadmap in Sharon's eyes, in Israeli interpretation, means the Palestinians must dismantle the organizations of terrorism. In other words, they must agree to a two-state solution with Israel and give up the military option.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, Israel will make territorial compromises and negotiate a final status deal. So far, there's been very little movement on the roadmap. All Sharon has really said is, trust me, I know the land, I know the way it smells, I know it's every border, I have experience. You know I'm a tough guy. I have the best interests of the country at heart. Vote for me. That was about the extent of his policy proclamation.
And finally, Steve, if Sharon gets this a freer hand in a new political structure there, very big picture, how do you see this intersecting with American interests in the region, in Iraq?
Well, I do think at the moment, though the Americans need to be careful not to interfere, Sharon is still their guy. I mean, and for many Israelis, you know, however difficult this election may be, he is the one political leader with the breadth and stature and experience and guts and toughness to get Israel out of this basically position of stagnation. He will, I think... he said that he didn't want another term just to keep the seat warm, which is why he wanted to leave Likud. And the thing that Likud would block him on most would be territorial compromise in the West Bank. So again, by inference, that's what he wants to do. But that's not what he says specifically that he wants to do. So I think, you know, anyone like Washington, which would like to be able to show Arabs in the world and Muslims in the world that progress is being made on the key issue of the foundation of a Palestinian state would probably feel that Sharon is best placed to proceed. Sharon, you know, in the roadmap, there is a second stage which calls for the establishment of an independent, sovereign Palestinian state, although within provisional borders, and then sees in a third stage negotiations between the State of Israel and this Palestinian state to finalize a deal. Sharon may not get that far, but I think the bets are that he, if he has to, will do another unilateral disengagement from the West Bank. A lot of this will happen, you know, will depend on Palestinian responses, to be honest. How well will Hamas do in the Palestinian parliamentary elections, which are due on January 25th, right in the middle of the Israeli campaign? How well will the moderate Mahmoud Abbas do, who favors a peaceful solution? This will have a big impact on whether Sharon or any other Israeli leader is able to move forward.
Steve Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Steve, thanks very much for the lay of the land. Steve Erlanger in Jerusalem. Joining us now from Jerusalem is Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, author of One Palestine Complete and the 7th Million. Tom Segev, thank you for being with us.
Hello.
So here we are, Ariel Sharon unbound. Where do you think this is headed? Where does this mean Israel is headed?
Well, first of all, I think that Sharon is now paying the political price for the disengagement from Gaza. As you know, most Israelis supported this step, but many did not, and particularly many in his own party. And I think that he just got fed up with his party, as Steve said. Sharon is a military man and remained a military man. He's also a politician. He's an adventurous man. He's a courageous man. And he took many unexpected steps before in his long career. Not all of them, by the way, were successful. In fact, sometimes it seems as if Sharon succeeded from failure to failure.
And now he's 77 and maybe making one of the biggest gambles of that long career. Tom Segev, stick with us. There's a lot we want to learn from you. I'm glad you're here. We're talking about Ariel Sharon, Remaking the Politics of Israel. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How do you read the Sharon earthquake? What's going on here? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ariel Sharon remaking the politics of Israel and maybe of the Middle East. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Where is Israel's old war horse, the bulldozer, headed now? And what does it mean for Mideast peace, for the United States, even for Iraq? How do you see Sharon's strategy, his vision, what it means for Israel, for the Palestinians? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Jerusalem by Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, author of One Palestine Complete and the 7th Million. Tom Segev, Ariel Sharon said that the Likud party is no longer lined up with Israel's national goals. How do you think he understands what those national goals are now?
I think he may have finally realized that the old ideology, the old belief, the old faith in the possibility of continuing the occupation forever is no longer valid. You know, the withdrawal from Gaza came under pressure of Palestinian terrorism. It's not the statesman Sharon that took us out of Gaza, it's the military man who realized that terrorism there cannot be defeated. And I think that as a pragmatic man, and again, always the military man, he realized that the old ideology has to be replaced by some more practical and more pragmatic probably compromises with the Palestinians. I think that he wants to hold on to as much territory, occupied territory, as possible. But unlike his colleagues in the Likud, he realizes that this cannot be done. And I think this is the difference now. So it's an interesting conflict because it is ideological. It's not only political. Of course, there's lots of politics involved and who will lead and and all that. But it is a real decision-making here, a historical decision which faces us. And Sharon leads us for the first time in a different direction.
So when you look at what people are describing as Ariel Sharon's evolution behind this decision, his own personal evolution, you're seeing it as evolution not exactly in a romantic sense in his soul, let's say, but rather an evolution in his understanding of the situation as a military analyst almost.
Always a military man, yes. Always a military man. And now a military man who leads a society that is very, very tired of politics, of war, of terrorism. Israelis right now don't really believe in the prospects of peace. They don't believe in particularly strongly in politics anymore. And I think that explains why we have so many parties that are placed in the center of politics. It's not right and left anymore. It's really most of Israeli politics are centrist politics. It's because Israelis are so tired of political confrontations, and so they look for some political refuge in the center.
And Ariel Sharon now moving to stand himself closer to that center. Tom Segev in Jerusalem, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome another voice into this conversation. Actually, on the road, en route from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, we're joined by Shai Feldman. He's director of the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University, was head of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University. Shai Feldman, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Shai, you've been very strong articulating the kind of peace camp view in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So what does Sharon's move say to you? Does this raise the prospect for peace there?
Well, I think that it's clear that Sharon's decision is a result of his determination to move the process forward. If he was not determined to move the process forward, he could have comfortably stayed within Likud. He would most likely have won the primaries. He would have most likely emerged given his immense popularity following the disengagement, implementation of the disengagement from Gaza. He would have most likely won the next elections. The problem is that he would have had a party within which there is a very strong minority, if not a slight majority, of opponents to the philosophy that Israel needs to move forward towards an accommodation with the Palestinians. And that either large minority or small majority would have made his life miserable, and he was definitely not about to accept that. So it's a clear indication that he's intent on moving forward.
Shai Feldman, let me ask you. Tom Segev says this is not exactly a philosophical evolution in Ariel Sharon, but a very pragmatic evolution of a military man looking at a map and what's possible and what's not. Do you see enough evolution signaled in this change by Sharon to really get to a point of peace with the Palestinians, or not?
Yeah. Well. First of all, it's not just Sharon. This is what we see in front of us now is a realignment of Israeli politics, and the reason is it's much deeper than the issue of Sharon. This realignment is caused by the fact that the strategic environment in which Israel operates and Israel's relations to that strategic environment is very, very different from the one that existed when Sharon entered politics on the eve of and most profoundly after the 1973 war. At that time, the principal threat facing Israel was a replay of the 73 war, large-scale attack by large conventional forces. At that time, because that was the principal threat, territory was very important, buffer zones were very important, Golda Meir's concept was of defensible borders, a need to distance the borders from Israel's large metropolitan areas. Sharon understands that the strategic map today is completely different. Essentially, Israel is the strongest military force in the region. There is no longer an Arab world. The Arab world is completely disorganized. Following the Iraq war, Iraq is no longer a military threat. And the principal threat now facing Israel is no longer large conventional forces, but rather the demographic trends which threaten Israel's future as a Jewish and democratic state. Mm-hmm. And that means a completely different strategy, a different policy, a policy that basically advocates Israel's going back to the borders of a Jewish state. And in a sense, almost this also changed the perception of what is entailed in the creation of a Palestinian state from something that was perceived as primarily a threat is something that's now perceived as almost a must, because it's now clear to more and more people that we're not going to have a Jewish state, or Israel is not going to have a Jewish state if there isn't a Palestinian state, if the Palestinians don't have a state of their own. And because territory has lost its importance, it basically split the hawkish camp in Israel between the religious historical hawks and the security hawks. And Ariel Sharon was the leader, was the quintessential leader of the security hawks. But the argument of the security hawks, Sharon understands, is no longer valid. And therefore, this is a real realignment. It's not just Sharon moving from one side to the other, but it's a whole host of people who used to be the arch-hawks of Israeli politics 20 years ago, 1985 or 1990. These were the people around Prime Minister Shamir, one of the most hawkish prime ministers in Israel's history. Now almost all of them have defected to the camp advocating disengagement. So this is a major realignment of Israeli politics.
Shai Feldman, on the road there to Jerusalem, you're breaking up a bit, but we're very glad to have had you. Thank you very much for joining us today. Shai Feldman with the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. Let me get a call. People are calling in to talk to Tom Segev. Kati is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Kati. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, and I want to preface it that I am a Hungarian Jew, so I do have a personal interest in Israel. But I think what Sharon did is absolutely brilliant. And
why?
It's so brave and courageous. And he realized that it has to be realized. The gentleman, while I was holding on, the gentleman said exactly what I was thinking, that it's time for Israel to realize that the only way there will be an Israeli state is if they move forward and towards peace with the Palestinians. And Sharon is doing the right thing. And if the party will not follow him, he needs to have a new party. It's just fantastic. I think it's wonderful news.
Kati, we've got it, and we hear the celebration in your view of it. Thanks for calling. Tom Segev, what about the remaining Likud party? I mean, the Jerusalem Post says they have now, whether they know it or not, lost their hegemony over Israeli politics. Would Benjamin Netanyahu agree? What happens to that view that says that wants Jewish sovereignty over the entire biblical land of Israel?
Well, I think the first reaction is one of great shock. They now have six, or maybe by now even seven, candidates to lead them, and they are going to have primaries. They are going to eat up each other first. But I think the one who represents the most hawkish and nationalistic view will win. I think it is going to be Netanyahu, former prime minister and well known in Israel and all over the world. He's probably the man who will lead the Likud, and it's going to be a very, very interesting campaign, because we are going to have Netanyahu, Sharon, and Amir Peretz, whom you mentioned before, who is leader of the Labor Party, an extremely interesting young man. And so, for once, Israeli politics is going to be interesting.
By your calculation, is there any way for Labor to come back into power? Peretz, just 53 years old, a longtime union leader, of course, pushed aside. Shimon Peres, who's, what, 80-something now, does Labor have a shot at leadership here?
Well, I think Shimon Peres is, at the moment, not relevant anymore in Israeli politics. I think he's looking for some international job, such as Secretary General of the UN or something nice like that. I think that before Sharon left Likud, Labor had a better chance. But now, of course, Sharon will take away some votes from Labor and some from Likud. And so, but it's difficult to say. But the interesting thing is that for the first time in many years, Labor now has a very interesting and intelligent statesman-like young man. And even if he doesn't succeed this time, he's very likely to become Israeli prime minister one time, so it's worth following his career.
Standing in the wings and not so far in the wings as we see a realignment unfolding. Alex is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi. I think that's a great issue, and I wanted to say that there is now a genuine hope for the Middle East in general, all the states in there, for democratically run states, since most of those states are basically taking the Palestinian issue as their main cause for their holding to power in there, and for the last 50 years been doing so.
You're saying Sharon's move makes democracy more likely across the region?
I think so, because I think now with the Palestinian issue going to be put to rest, hopefully, in a positive way, legitimate Palestinian state, and the Israelis next to them. So the focus of the most of the countries around them and the populations will be to internal issues, not to external issues as it has been for the last 50 years.
If that Palestinian issue can indeed be put to rest, of course, that's a very big if even now. But we've got the view, Alex, and we thank you for your call. Joining us now from New York, along with Tom Segev in Jerusalem, is Ambassador Martin Indyk. He was U.S. Ambassador to Israel from 1995 to 97, and again from 2000 to 2001. He's director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Martin Indyk, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
What about the caller's presumption that this moves Israel and the Palestinians significantly closer to a real resolution and therefore is a hopeful sign step for the entire region? Do you share that view, Ambassador Indyk?
Well, that's one scenario, and it's obviously the hopeful and optimistic scenario, and it might happen, but it will depend on whether what happens on the Palestinian side. The Israeli body politic over the last few months has gone through this wrenching process of as it were, getting rid of Gaza. And it did so unilaterally under Sharon's leadership. And the general attitude in Israel today is that it worked, that they kind of got rid of responsibility for 1.2 million Palestinians in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a pretty good model for dealing with the West Bank as well. And Sharon's unilateralism with Gaza could well be applied in the West Bank if it emerges that Hamas wins the Palestinian elections or dominates the polity over there and the Israelis feel that they don't have a Palestinian partner, in which case Sharon would likely win the next election, set up a center-left coalition, but instead of going into negotiations with the Palestinians, the optimistic scenario, he might well lead a further unilateral step, even though he denies it, denied it yesterday as his intention.
Mm-hmm.
But I can easily see him going that way if the Palestinians are unable to get their act together and stop terrorist attacks and present the Israeli public with a reliable, accountable, effective partner for a final status negotiation.
Martin Indyk, the United States clearly has terrible problems now in Iraq and maybe even regionally. How important is it to America's future and its policy in the Middle East for the Israelis and Palestinians to come to some kind of solution? Do you imagine Condoleezza Rice putting a new level of pressure on Ariel Sharon on her recent visit there? How big a deal is this for Americans for this to get worked out, maybe under a new Sharon party?
Well, I think it's important in terms of America's overall standing in the region, which is taking a real pummeling now because of the stumbling in Iraq and the problems we're facing there. There's been a lot of anger generated by the Bush administration's previous detachment from the effort to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Secretary of State's involvement now is, I think, welcomed overall in the region. And if indeed there's a center-left coalition that Sharon puts together following the elections in March, that will provide the United States with an Israeli partner for a negotiating process and will make it easier, I think, for Condoleezza Rice to pursue the instincts that have already manifested themselves in terms of her recent involvement. And that will, if you follow the logic chain, redound, I think, to the benefit of the United States in terms of our playing a leadership role in trying to resolve a conflict that creates that has a great deal of resonance in the broader Middle East.
Martin Indyk in New York and Tom Segev in Jerusalem, we're so glad to have both of you with us. We've got big news coming out of Israel, and we're looking at it closely in this hour. Please stick with us. Listeners, you can join us as well. We're talking about Ariel Sharon remaking the politics of Israel. And maybe you're hearing here of the Middle East. You can join the conversation. How do you see Sharon's strategy, his vision? Do you agree with what he describes as Israel's national goals? Do you agree that the Likud party was not any longer aligned with those goals? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear a Likud voice in just a minute, and later in the hour, a view on what's going on with General Motors. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Ariel Sharon remaking the politics of Israel and maybe of the region. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined in this hour from Jerusalem by Tom Segev, columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, author of One Palestine Complete, by former U.S. Ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk, joining us from New York, and right now from Jerusalem by Naomi Blumenthal. She's a member of the Likud party, which Ariel Sharon is now leaving. She's said she will not be joining Ariel Sharon in his new party. Naomi Blumenthal, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
Was there any question in your mind? Are you thinking about whether or not to go with Sharon?
No, there is no question about it, because we have to understand that Ariel Sharon, who was leading the Likud party in the last election and the former election, we got 40 members of parliament out of the 120. But he switched his policy. He switched actually the policies and wanted to lead a completely different policy and values and ideology than it was on the platform of the Likud. So we, Likud members, and I was among the members of parliament who were called the rebels, and we were against these maneuvers of Ariel Sharon.
Right.
Finally, he concluded that he concluded it, and he found himself outside of the Likud party.
Ms. Blumenthal, let me ask you, the Jerusalem Post today says that Likud's seemingly shatterproof and increasingly abusive hegemony, their words, of Israeli politics has effectively come to its end. We're also hearing in this hour that the vision of Jewish sovereignty over the entire biblical land of Israel has been dealt a real setback by all this. Do you agree? Is Likud now at the end of its hegemony, at the end of its vision?
No, of course not at all. But the Likud has, and we have, to bring ourselves back to ourselves, no question about it. There is a certain time in which we have quite a crisis, because as for Mr. Sharon, who in a way needs now a new party where he can decide everything, it's very far from democracy, but it is like the ultra-Orthodox. The ultra-Orthodox, we were always against the fact that there are no inner elections. So in the Likud party, in the new party of Mr. Sharon, there won't be any inner election. He will decide everything. He will lead it. He will decide who is in the list, in what capacity in the list, and etc.
But if Israel's becoming more centrist, we've heard in the conversation this hour, does that mean that Likud's future looks less promising?
No, in a way, I just want to explain why does it come in this this period of time, we are in a less favorable situation than Mr. Sharon. And therefore, the polls of today are very bad for Likud. But this might change. We have to understand the Likud is an established party. We will have inner elections for our leader. Who is going to be the leader of the Likud party? Sharon just left. He deserted. So who is going to be the leader? There will be inner elections. So I think that everyone who evaluates, and like the Americans, democracy, can understand that inside the party, mm-hmm. we will have the inner election. Of course, it is a less favorable situation, because till we have a leader, it will take another 2-3 weeks. And we have some contenders. We have, as we all know, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu,
yep.
Mr. Silvan Shalom, we have Katz, we have the former the Minister of Security and Defense, Mr. Mofaz, so we have about 6 contenders for the position. Till we know who is the leader, then we can start to campaign much better, and I'm sure that the Likud will come, maybe not to 40 members of parliament out of the 120, but I'm nearly sure that we will regain our power, which will mean that center and right will become stronger than the polls show today.
So a voice of Likud still expressing a determination, optimism there. Naomi Blumenthal in Jerusalem, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let me turn to Shlomo, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Shlomo, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think, my friend?
I'm glad to hear this is a rare occasion when you have, when you're attempting to balance the two sides. So you brought somebody from the left, such as Shai Feldman and Tom Segev, and a member of the Likud.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very welcome. I wish there was more balance. Now, I'd like to address several statements made and ask a question. The demographic myth referred to Shai Feldman. That is, actually, there is no. The threat is misperceived.
This is Shai Feldman saying there won't be a Jewish state if there aren't two states because the Palestinian population will outstrip the Israelis. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds,
right,
there, Shlomo. But what's your bottom line on the Sharon departure?
Well, the bottom line is another statement that Shai Feldman made was that the threat from other Arab states no longer exists, and it's purely now an internal issue between Israel and Palestinians. I mean, extremist threats still exist. It's changing. The Palestinians are always being used as pawns in the games of surrounding Arab states against Israel. So that's wishful thinking.
Do you think Sharon will reach a peace deal with the Palestinians?
He might. He might not. It might be that he's playing a very, very clever game. One has to realize the demographics of Israel, which is not much talked about. The Palestinian population that was presumed to be 3.8 million people in Gaza and the West Bank is actually not that. It's about 2.4, as studies have shown.
So you're going to argue with the demographics and thinking maybe Sharon has got a strategy within the strategy here. Shlomo, I want to get back to Tom Segev in Jerusalem. Thank you for your call. Tom, what about it? I put it to you again. Do you see Sharon, with the new security calculation that you say he's made, reaching a point where he can come to a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians or not?
I think that in the spirit of balance, we should not forget that it was under Sharon, it was the Sharon government, which continued the extremely harsh oppression of the Palestinians and systematic violations of human rights. And I think it's important to remember that Sharon has not all of a sudden discovered a vision of peace. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is extremely difficult to solve. I think that it's one of those conflicts which can be better managed, and I certainly believe that Sharon will manage it in a more rational way. But I think I should warn you from the thought that this is a man who has a peace plan in his pocket, certainly not one that he can realize. The Palestinian side is also extremely complicated. You've heard before from Steve Erlinger that they are in the midst of their own election campaign, and elections for both Palestinians and Israelis usually don't mean more moderation, but more hawkish views, more supposedly more patriotic views. So it's difficult. Also, Sharon has a credibility problem, as Ambassador Indyk mentioned before. He now promises not to undertake any more unilateral withdrawals, but people don't believe him anymore, or many people don't believe him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So while he meets a lot of enthusiasm today, and just as the listener, Kathy, I think, many people share her enthusiasm here in Israel. But I think that, again, in the spirit of balance, we should not be over optimistic and not expect too much from Sharon.
Martin Indyk, at the very bottom here, Tom Segev says Ariel Sharon has looked deeply into this and learned something as a military man about what's possible and what's not. What's your sense of the basic learning that's gone on in these decades that we've all watched this conflict unfold? What have the Israelis learned, maybe now in the person of Ariel Sharon and his move, and the Palestinians, have they taken away, are they taking away lessons that move us closer to peace or not?
I think what the Israelis have learned from 4 years of bloody violence and terrorism of the Intifada is that it's not in their interests to rule over the Palestinians. And the driving political force in Israel today is a force for separation from the Palestinians. That's what produced the disengagement from Gaza, and that's what has produced this fence that is being built more or less along the Green Line, the 67 borders between the West Bank and Israel, not because Sharon wants to build a fence there, in fact he was against building the fence, but because that's the only way that you can, that a political leader like Sharon, who has his finger on the pulse of the Israeli electorate, can meet their demand for separating from the Palestinians. As a consequence of that driving force, most Israelis, talking about probably two-thirds or more of Israelis, have left the West Bank, not just Gaza, in their minds. And Ariel Sharon, who is by far and away the smartest Israeli politician and the most agile, understands that. The other factor is Sharon himself, who feels that he bears on his shoulders the responsibility for the future and the longevity of the Jewish state of Israel. I agree with Tom Segev that the question of a peace plan is really moot. What Ariel Sharon has is a new map. He used to walk around with a map of settlements, his settlements that he was building. Now he has a new map in his pocket. And that's what he intends to do in splitting from the Likud and hopefully leading a new center-left coalition government.
And a new map that shows a more secure Israel, somehow.
To finalize the borders of the state. Not necessarily through a peace negotiation, although he would do it if it could work that way, but if necessary through unilateral moves, which will consolidate the three major settlement blocks along the Green Line in the West Bank in Israel's hands, and he's building the fence around those three settlement blocks, and Jerusalem. As he always says, united Jerusalem, the eternal capital of Israel. That's what he considers as necessary to ensure that there is a robust Jewish majority in control of Jerusalem for the future. And if he achieves that, either through negotiations with the Palestinians or with the Americans or unilaterally, that's what his purpose is, I believe, in splitting from the Likud, who would prevent him from doing that, and basically playing that out over the next 4 years. So I think that's where Israel is headed, and in that regard, I believe he has majority support amongst the Israeli public.
A new map in the pocket of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, heading off with a new party. Ambassador Martin Indyk in New York, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Tom Segev, columnist for Haaretz, author of One Palestine Complete and The 7th Million, The Israelis and the Holocaust. Tom, thanks as always for being with us.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, we'll look at the fallout of the big GM layoffs. This is On Point. General Motors released yesterday details of a 3-year blueprint for survival. 30,000 workers will lose their jobs, 5,000 more than previously announced, and 9 plants in the U.S. and Canada will be shuttered by the end of 2008. The auto giant's losses are mushrooming, almost $4 billion in the first 9 months of this year, and industry watchers and GM workers have been expecting drastic cuts. But not everyone believes these cuts will solve the company's core problems. Joining me now from Detroit is Lee Hawkins. He's a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. His beat is GM. Lee Hawkins, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So there's been a lot of bad news on this front, but it was another big announcement by the head of GM yesterday. How's it going down today in Detroit?
Well, there's a lot of uncertainty around General Motors still, despite the fact that they announced these plant closings. These were anticipated plant closings, but the company now has to do well with its line of SUVs and trucks that come out, or it could face a bigger market share deterioration.
We talked about GM and bankruptcy some months ago on this show. We had people call in and say, no way, no how, General Motors is never going down. Is that clear?
Well, certainly it's not clear that General Motors is never going to file bankruptcy, but if at all possible, the company is doing everything it can to avoid a bankruptcy. And they have so many different constituencies that depend on this company. A GM bankruptcy would have catastrophic implications. Suppliers across the country would no longer exist. So they're going to do everything they can to stop it.
Lee, you spent time in GM communities and plants over the last few months, over the summer, talking with people anticipating what was coming here. How do you see the mentality among GM managers, among union leaders, among workers? How are people looking at this great giant and its travail?
There's a general view across America's heartland that the real issue here is that the company just is having a difficult time staying competitive because they're on unequal footing with the Japanese automaker in the area of health care, pensions. They have huge legacy costs, and I think the company has done a very good job of communicating that to people. And so what you're finding is union members across the country are talking about their willingness to give up things in order to keep the company afloat, and I think that's what we saw with the health care concessions that they made earlier this year.
But when you look at these multi-billion-dollar losses and the prospect of them stretching out for many years, can the unions give up enough just from the labor side to save GM?
That's a very good question, because the labor costs only represent about 20% of GM's overall costs. And the company can continue to cut plants. They can close as many plants as they want. But right now, what they really, really need to do is get some cars that sell. They need to boost their market share, because if they don't do that, the plant closings aren't going to do enough, because there's just too much that they have to make up for.
And what about the union charge that this is at bottom evidence of a management failure at General Motors?
Well, there are several things that have happened in over the past year that could potentially signal that management made some mistakes, but I'm not surprised to hear the union say that. And at this point, the company says that it's looking forward and not looking at the things that it did. For instance, the decision that they needed to pay out Fiat $1.2 billion over their put agreement, and all kinds of things that were just unforeseen. And so now what we're seeing is the management trying to forget about the past and move forward.
Tom, we just got 20 seconds. Is there some kind of miracle product in the back pocket that's going to sell like, hot biscuits, going to make it all back?
Not that I see yet. The line of SUVs look great, but it's hard to say because of the gas prices and the general stigma towards SUVs and trucks. Now, maybe something can happen along the way, but there's no shining star, high-volume shining star in GM's portfolio at this point. We'll have to wait and see.
Lee Hawkins with the Wall Street Journal covers GM. Lee, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.